see. Thank you very much, Luis, and it's a pleasure to see Luis Miñones after these many years. And he's right. He was a young man of 10 or 12, I think we figured out, when I was doing my doctoral research in Peru some years ago, and his mother, Blanca Figueroa, was kind enough to invite me to stay with them in their place in Lima for some time before I went up to my Andean site. And so I have wonderful recollections of that, and I always see Blanca when I go back there, which I will be doing again on Sunday. So that's tomorrow, isn't it? So. Okay, I have notes, and I'm not sure. I guess I can close this, and then just I will open it as needed. And I want to also begin. Am I knocking this out? Oh, I'm knocking everything out of whack. Okay. Okay, so I can't do that. Is there a place to put it? No, I'm sorry. I'm wrecking the technology. I'm just going to have to set my notes on top of it, I guess. Okay, the finest laid plans with technology. That would be really helpful to put that down there. Yeah. Could we do that?
Where?
Can we put this on the chair so that I can put my notes up here?
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'll be tripping and knocking it over. So, yeah. I want to thank Ben Falah very much for his invitation to come here to Colby and to others in the Latin American Studies program. Here at Colby as well. It's been a pleasure, and because I did come up here during my early summers, my father was from Maine, I found it really wonderful to come back and have a day yesterday, part of a day to drive, even in the rain with a fall foliage weekend, to see a cousin I hadn't seen in many decades, I'll just say. And so it was really, really terrific. I'm also delighted to be in the company of the other speakers here, and I can see that from the four of us and our four topics were rather diverse, and at the same time I think we'll find some points of intersection that we'll get to more in the follow-up session. I did notice in looking at the titles of the other three that they all have violence or armed conflict in them, and I want to say that there's no shortage of that in Peru's recent history. However, I don't have that in my title, and although my recent book that came out this year does look at tourism in post-revolutionary and post-conflict areas, I'll be emphasizing some different things today, and perhaps if you want to talk a little bit about the post-conflict aspect of tourism, we can get to that a little bit later. However, I have added into my title from what was originally proposed the words cultural tourism, and so I will be looking at the theorizations of gender and race and cultural tourism in the Peruvian Andes, something that I'm working on currently. So, having said that, you're going to see this slide for a while. I'll get into showing you some other slides. I don't have a great number of them, but I wanted to give you some images, some slides of the Peruvian context where I've been working, and we'll get to more of those soon. While the talk I'll give today draws on research that I've carried out since 2005 for my book, which came out this year as The Tourism Encounter, some of the ideas span several decades, from the time when I began my research in the Peruvian Andes in 1977 through my most recent trips last year and this year while I'm currently on sabbatical in Peru. My latest book, as it has been my broadest to date, sticking my neck out more than a little to examine tourism as a lens for considering the remaking or reimagining of four Latin American regions and nations that have been through significant periods of transition stemming from revolution or conflict of one kind or another. My next book project, which I am at work on now in research, and I thought sharing too much of that would be a little premature at this point, but it's inspired by the work I'm presenting here. It's a close reexamination of feminist anthropological debates that emerged in the 1970s and later stalled, having to do with gender asymmetry in the Andes, whether it derived from traditional Andean culture or from colonial European and urban Latin American practices and ideologies. Based on my current research in Peru, I'll push beyond the past debates to formulate a new framework of analysis that I call a feminist anthropology of indigeneity. The work will examine gendered and racialized subjectivities of Andean people, exploring in particular how being both indigenous and female contributes to identity formation in the nation's post-conflict neoliberal era. Although gender and racial inequalities persist, there is arguably greater purchase in being female and indigenous as a result of cultural heritage tourism, education, and opportunities brought about through urbanization and indigenous social movements that are pressing for greater inclusion and cultural rights. When I made my first trip to Peru in 1977, I know it seems like a very, very long time ago, scholarly attention to gender and ethnicity in the Americas was emerging, in part as a result of the UN Conference on Women held in Mexico City in 1975. At that time, the lines were often sharply drawn between those who viewed indigenous women in Latin America as part of an age-old cultural hinterland in which gender inequality was powerfully entrenched, and those, disproportionately anthropologists, who maintained that gender complementarity, and here I think of people like Olivia Harris, Billie Jean Isbell, Irene Silverblatt, and I would, I think, probably include myself here, was disrupted when European interventions brought new inequality to rural communities from urban centers. Now we're at a time of neoliberal globalization that has brought about further disruptions and has meant both new challenges and opportunities for such indigenous communities. Within the time of what John and Jean Comaroff recently have referred to as Ethnicity Inc. Incorporated, when authentic cultural identities are commodified and marginalized peoples may find contradictory openings for entrepreneurial success. While we might understandably take a cynical view of these developments, we should remember that we're also in a time of emergent indigenous social movements in the Andean region and elsewhere, and the valorization of cultural identity that accompanies such movements is not so much about commodification as about social struggle. When, for example, in 2009, the Peruvian city of Puno played host to over 6,000 delegates from 22 nations who had gathered for the Fourth Continental Summit of Indigenous Peoples, it was preceded by a two-day women's summit, which itself drew more than 2,000 indigenous women who made it clear that their voices would be heard. Two decades ago, after the earlier debates on Andean gender and ethnic relations had sedimented into differences over complementarity versus inequality, Marisol de la Cadena offered an assessment that appeared to support the latter view. She wrote, and I quote, "It is in the intimacy of everyday relations in the street, marketplace, and village that implicit decisions and identities are made about who is and who is not Indian. Modernization has reinforced the Indianization of women while opening the option of cultural mestizaje to most men," end of quote. Marisol de la Cadena, for those who may not know her name, is a cultural anthropologist from Peru who is on the faculty at UC Davis. Increasingly, it became common knowledge that Andean women are considered more Indian, which I put in quotes, than their male counterparts, and for this they suffer from deeper social inequalities. Nonetheless, more recently, De La Cadena, writing with Oren Starn, suggests a more contemporary, nuanced understanding of indigenous lives and activism on a global scale that may offset her earlier view. Here I want to suggest that we need to re-examine gender and indigenous identities in new ways to see what meanings may inhere in these identities when gender is taken as seriously as ethnicity. Such an approach to identity formation has resonated among several scholars working in the region. I think of Mary Weismantle, Andrew Canessa. I think Krista Van Vliet here might place herself in this category as well, as it calls for a more subtle reading of cultural meanings and practices that are laden with differences of gender, race, and power. Others, including Ben Orlov, Deborah Poole, have examined the politics of race in colonial and post-colonial times in Peru. The intersectionality of gender, race, and nation is a familiar framework for feminists working around the globe, and it has found considerable acceptance among social analysts and cultural theorists more broadly. Yet, intersectionality has not often been historicized so as to allow us to observe the uneven manner in which change occurs. Under the new terms of engagement emerging in Andean Peru and beyond, I want to suggest two things. First, tourism has become a particularly robust site for re-examining what is at stake in the notion that women are more Indian, to quote Marisol de la Cadena, and second, that what has been a social liability, being both female and indigenous, can serve in some cases as a form of cultural capital, and using the sense of Pierre Bourdieu that some of you may know as an anthropologist working on questions of cultural capital. In his collection on gender, indigeneity, and the state in the Andes, Andrew Canessa notes that the Indian, and here I'm quoting him, the Indian has become an international commodity, and Indians are widely recognized around the globe for their traditional lifestyles and as guardians of the natural environment, end of the quote. An essentialized notion of indigenous people may be a form of Orientalism, after Said, or imperialist nostalgia, after Renato Rosaldo, imposed from outside indigenous societies. However, under the terms of international tourism, indigenous women and men themselves deploy notions of traditional or authentic cultural difference as a strategy to attract more tourists. Thus, it is critical to consider the active ways in which, as Canessa and his collaborators show, indigenous people on the margins play a part in making the nation by becoming stakeholders in their own identity construction. Women, notably through their use of dress and language, preparation of meals, once again are shown to be the principal signifiers of traditional culture, the indigenous, and other. Following the period of political upheaval in Peru, there's been a tourism revival in the region. A well-established tourism industry was halted in Peru during the 1980s and into the 90s by ruthless forces of Sendero Luminoso, Shining Path, and the military. Now tourism is thriving once again as conflict has subsided and the nation has sought to promote economic development and to refashion regional and national identities in a time of neoliberalism. In what follows, I examine how recent developments relating to culture, political economy, and tourism in post-conflict Andean Peru are reflected by race and gender. I discuss ways in which local cultures as well as tourism industries in these regions market indigenous identity and gender difference, sometimes building on historical practices or ideologies, and at times making unabashed use of stereotypes of the other. I'll offer examples of these practices in the community of Vicos, Peru, which for those in anthropology, you may know is a famous site of an applied anthropology project of the 50s and 60s, where tourists often travel to experience a safe and remote indigenous community that has withstood the passage of time. Looking at this initiative in cultural tourism, I suggest that tourism encounters in the region, as elsewhere, are heavily freighted with difference and power, even as they provide the community with new opportunities for economic development and cultural revalorization. Okay. Just a title slide for a moment. So gender, race, and tourism in the Peruvian Andes. Since the period of violence and conflict when Shining Path militants faced off with the military during the 1980s and into the 1990s, which led to the tragic loss of nearly 70,000 lives, tourism has returned to Peru. Specifically, cultural tourism has reemerged, attracting visitors with the promise of exposure not only to spectacular settings and archaeological wonders, but to intimate encounters with rural and indigenous Andeans themselves. While scholars have usefully considered travelers' romanticization of rural Andeans and their spiritual connection to the natural and supernatural world, Michael Hill has written about this, also Vandenberg and Flores Ochoa, gender differentiation in the tourism encounter is less often examined. Gender differences appear in the performance and delivery of a number of traditional tourism services in Andean Peru. Jane Enrisi has examined how tourism development, cultural heritage, and local economy impact women, particularly when the marketing of traditional arts and practices is viewed as a key to modernization. As Walter Little discovered in Guatemala, cultural tourism often builds on notions of indigenous and female difference, and women themselves, more often than men, present themselves as indígenas. Local identity marked by dress, language, and demeanor are strong and strongly inflected by gender is a critical factor in Peru's tourism development. The close connection of gender and race or ethnicity in the Andes is clear in De La Cadena's work in the community near Cusco, where she reported the perception that women are more Indian. While both men and women may acquire modern skills and be perceived as less Indian and more mestizo, for women the advantage to be gained is more modest. She found that, quote, gender intersects with status to structure and legitimate ethnic inequality within the community and even within households, end of quote. Elaine Zorn's work on Tequila Island in Peru offers a rare case study of community-based tourism that met with some early success. Interestingly, while men were centrally involved in transporting tourists to the island, women had an equally important role as the main producers of their celebrated textiles on sale to tourists. Women were prominent in social and economic exchanges with tourists, even when this contributed to tensions that emerged between tequila men and women over access to tourism's benefits. In the end, however, it was competition for mestizo transporters that led to local men's displacement from the business of tourism, eroding this communitarian project. My research on Peruvian tourism, and I've attempted to locate my work in the context of that of others, focused on cultural and experiential tourism, known locally as turismo vivencial, in the Cajon de Huaylas in north-central Peru, an area best known for adventure travel and mountaineering. Responses to my interviews indicated that a majority of travelers, and here I can move to a slide from Vicos Peru. Responses to my interviews indicated that a majority of travelers come to the area for cultural and ecotourism. As one Spanish teacher from the United States wrote, she was most surprised that, quote, it is relatively authentic, though I've only been in the north so far. The campesinos aren't what I expected, posing in their quaint dress for a sol, the Peruvian currency. Instead, they seem to patiently deal with our tourist presence, spying on their customs, which are not staged. I found the last part of her quotation interesting, and it's an area of some controversy in anthropology, what is staged and performed tourism. An Israeli man who came to Peru following his military service captured the elements that drew him to the country. Quote, beautiful scenery, amazing people, and as a backpacker, it's rather cheap, end of quote. Many are struck by what a French woman described as, quote, the kindness of people and how helpful they are, the way they're living with a strict minimum and seem to be happier than people like us who have everything so easily, end of quote. Similarly, a man from the Netherlands appreciated, quote, the endless solidarity and cariño, affection, of the poor people, end of quote. While I've been based in the city of Huaraz, capital of the Department of Ancash, I have observed travel throughout the Cajon region. Vicos, an Andean community well known in the history of applied anthropology, has recently undertaken a small tourism project with the assistance of nearby NGOs. I've made short visits to Vicos over 3 decades and stayed there for several days in 2006 and again in 2010 as a guest in order to learn more about how a handful of families with support to build guest lodges scattered over rugged terrain has fared in launching this project. Those acquainted with the Cornell Peru project of the 50s and 60s may recognize this enterprise as a logical extension of development initiatives of the past. By now, however, the casinos themselves are seeking to manage the business of drawing travelers, largely from the United States, but also Europe, for stays of a few days or more, during which they participate in the everyday activities of the rural agricultural community. A selling point for potential visitors is the opportunity to get to know about the lives and culture of a traditional indigenous Quechua-speaking people. Having conducted archival research on gender relations in Vicos during the time of the Cornell Peru project, long ago, I was eager to see how Vicos might be approaching tourism as a new means for economic development. In Huaraz, my usual base where I've done work over a number of years, about an hour from Vicos, I visited the NGOs that were supporting Vicos's tourism project and that were assisting in arranging my travel to Vicos. I was given 2 versions of an attractive brochure on Vicos tourism. One, as you can see, on experiential tourism in English, and Turismo Vivencial in Spanish. The brochure serves to orient prospective and current visitors for their stay in the peasant community of Vicos, which I think you see here. Yes, a direct experience with families that live in the Andean Mountains, end of their quote. Images and text offer a brief history of Vicos from the time when it was, as they describe it, a typical Andean hacienda from 1611 to 1952, to the time of the Cornell Project. The present is described by reference to the continuing biodiversity and traditional culture in the region. What most caught my attention were the photos and descriptions of the 8 hosts of tourism homestays, as well as of other residents of Vicos. I know you can't read this text, but you can get a sense of the images in the brochure. The hosts and other local specialists are all men, Pablo, Julian, Manuel, Avito, and so on. The photos in a few cases include women, the wives of the hosts, but the descriptions all emphasize what tourists will experience by staying with or meeting a craftsman, a beekeeper, a musician, a weaver, or a toolmaker, all men. Women are strikingly absent from this portrayal of everyday life in Vicos. Thus, I was prepared to ask some questions about how women were involved in the tourism project and to seek the opportunity to meet and talk with Vicosinas themselves. My visits to Vicos brought to light the gendered and racialized nature of the experience, suggesting that these social vectors continue to be salient as they are elsewhere, and that tourism development efforts have differential consequences for women and men in the community. In part, this may result from the greater difficulty women have in speaking Spanish, given past practices of sending sons to school or the military while daughters remained at home. It may also stem from the perception identified by De La Cadena that rural women are more Indian and less modern, less able to fulfill key responsibilities in tourism development. Though I have shown that elsewhere in the Callejón de Huaylas, women play active roles in the local economy. I learned that only Vicosino men attend the tourism workshops or talleres in Huaylas. There, they are given advice on how to receive guests and interact with them, including suggestions that family members should eat all together and offer commentaries on how things were done in the past and how traditions are continuing in the present. My host during my first tourist stay, whom I call Tomas, explained that relating to tourists was very new to them, and for his wife, Dora, as I call her, it produced considerable anxiety since her Spanish was very limited and she was not sure how she would manage. While it might be that women are the principal conservators of culture and tradition in Vicos, the men are the ones who were expected to pass on such knowledge to their guests. Tomás spoke frequently and reverentially of the time of their grandparents, los abuelos, and even as the radio or TV played loudly from their place, he emphasized that things are much the same now as in the past. As the male head of household, he played host while Dora provided the critical and labor-intensive services of preparing the guest quarters and meals. It might interest you to know that in the guest quarters where I stayed, there was no light or electricity, no electricity or water. However, in their home next door, they had electricity, water, and, as I said, TV and radio. So, you know, it was the notion of the authenticity that we were hearing about, I was experiencing. So, during my visit, the couple was attentive to my needs, but Dora remained largely behind the scenes while Tomas interacted with me directly. He called me to meals that she prepared, except in the case of the pachamanca, the traditional Andean barbecue on my last day, which was prepared by Vicosino men and then served by the women. I'll show you some slides of this just in a moment. He escorted me to a local wedding, and she joined us only after carrying out work at home. While he delivered a speech at the time of my departure, she was shy and scarce. Both were kind and hospitable, but Tomas performed the role of gracious host and family spokesperson. This led me to question whether the Vicosinos and those who have assisted them in the tourism project could have integrated women in the community to a greater degree. Are women in Vicos simply too busy with household responsibilities to be more active participants in the tourism project? Or is the androcentrism of the tourism project repeating past practices of interventions in Vicos that singled out men for economic development projects? Let me show you just a few slides here. Give you a sense of the tourism experience. They, of course, knew I was an anthropologist. I was taking notes in my journal and my notebook and so on. But they had a practice of delivering on the tourism days. And so part of that was that my host would prepare bread, and he did this. He was quite insistent that I should get out my camera. My camera was faltering, and he really didn't want to get too involved in the bread making until I was ready to take the pictures to document the experience. In this picture, you can see his wife, who is behind the scenes. This is actually a rather dark, unlit space of a kitchen, but with my flash, it comes out looking a little more clear. She, as I said, was the one to regularly prepare the meals and do the work of supporting the family behind the scenes often, but there she is. For the Pachamanca, the traditional Andean barbecue at the end of the visit, and this is something they generally include, the men are the ones participating in setting up the barbecue, and you'll see that women will serve. Still preparing. I might mention that two students I work with at the University of Florida are here on the scene in this foray into tourism in Vigas. Part of the Pachamanca day is experiencing some of the local culture and traditional culture. The musicians in this case, you'll also see men who are weaving and musicians. Happens to be a Peace Corps volunteer in this photo. Peace Corps was kicked out of Vicas some decades back, and then they were allowed back in. And so when I was there, there was a young man who had been working with the tourism project for a couple of years. He was preparing to leave and was, I think, well integrated in the community. Oh, okay, so participating in the tourism experience, yes, we were expected also to admire the works of the community and to purchase a few items. So there I am with the Vicosinos trying on a woven belt. Okay, I'll explain this one. A few days after that stay in Vicos, I returned there for an afternoon in order to see the much longer standing visitor attraction operated by the Vicos community, the thermal baths and hotel at Chancos, alongside of the community. Vicosinos are much more in evidence in the Chancos enterprise, playing a significant part in the operation of the baths, hotel, small restaurants, and market stalls that are concentrated along the quiet road that leads into Vicos. The women vendors and restaurant workers I spoke to were comfortable in Spanish, and those I spoke to, and by the way, I have only the most limited Quechua. Most of the people that I work with in Peru are bilingual. I use Spanish. I did start a Quechua course when I was in Peru just in September, so, you know, for what that may be worth, we'll see. So they were comfortable in Spanish, and those I spoke to told me they were not familiar with the tourism project, though they were interested in hearing about it. I was particularly impressed by the active role of these women in contrast to those connected to the tourism project. The women at Chancos were regarded as cholas, women bearing characteristics of both campesinas, peasant women, and mestizas, townswomen, who had adapted to the world of urban commerce and interacted with a wider social network. The tourism project, however, sought to represent Vicos women as occupying a more domesticated, non-market world, even in the face of their long-standing participation in decision-making in a market economy. Tourists come to Vicos to see Indians leading traditional lives and not to see savvy women bargaining with buyers in the market. Larger towns and cities like Huaraz are where tourists go to visit busy markets and haggle over prices. In such towns, there is a more diverse cross-section of society, and social differences stand out in sharp relief. A fascinating touristic display of the contrasting provincial Andean and elite cultures of Peru is found in the regional sales of knockoff Barbies in handmade outfits identified as chola. As Chola, urbanized Indian, and De Lima from the capital city. I'm not sure if you see, you don't see the Barbies De Lima here, but there are some who have hand-knit outfits that are more urban style, skirts and blouses and so forth. So I have acquired a few of those in my line of work. In vicos, however, cultural commodification is better concealed, and there is little need for cash during a tourist stay, unless it is to give a host a small amount to purchase coca leaves for an Indian ritual, until the end of the visit, when there is a quick accounting of the payment due. Tourists are spared from learning a family's urgent need for cash for children's school supplies, household items, or transportation into nearby towns, and of women's central role in managing household budgets. It remains to be seen how tourism will fare in Vicos and how men and women will collaborate in this initiative. Although I have noted that men are the designated hosts and play the leading public role in experiential tourism in the community, women are critically important to its success. This is evident from the work of women in preparing guest quarters for visitors and in the labor-intensive work of preparing meals. The complementarity of gender roles in Vicos is arguably as apparent today as it was 30 years ago. Just as the significant part of women in the community may have eluded the Applied Anthropology Project some decades back, I would suggest that external supporters, NGOs and travel companies, of the tourism initiative may also be overlooking the key part played by women. When Tomas told me of his wife's nervousness about his becoming a socio, a member of the project, I believe he was also signaling his own anxiety that without her full support, he could not make a go of it. A wider recognition of the significance of women in the project and more generally in Vicos might have positive effects going beyond the tourism project. Last section, Indigenous women and tourism. When De La Cadena described Andean women as more Indian, and I find this a very provocative notion that you can see I'm working with in this piece, she parted ways with analysts who earlier found only harmony and complementarity among Andean women and men. She acknowledged that those women who gained experience as marketers were already acquiring the modern urban skills that might enable them to appear less Indian and more mestizo, but she claimed that local men and women devalued such activity as not really work. How does the rise of tourism, and particularly cultural tourism, affect the balance of gender relations among Indigenous people in the Andes? Is work in tourism regarded as meaningful and worthy? We have seen that Indigenous women are often viewed as the most culturally authentic members of their communities, and as such may have an economic advantage in tourism when they produce items and sell it to the public or interact in other ways with tourists. Does this result in their higher status in local cultures? Does marketing their identity as traditional or Indigenous benefit them in other ways? Recent research in Cusco, in the Cusco area, supports the view that women are finding new ways to market their identities as well as their products in the tourism economy. For example, women and children who pose for photos using folkloric dress and sometimes iconic alpacas to cater to tourist preferences have become commonplace enough that individuals serving as models are referred to as sacame fotos, take my pictures. And they are very photogenic. However, like men performing as bricheros, some of you may have heard about bricheros in the Cusco area, men who, and can be women also, but seeking, in the case of men, seeking women's affection on the tourism market, these women gain new sources of income without necessarily gaining respect in the family and community. The work is not regarded as worthy in the way the work of artisans in the region is considered to be honorable. Gender and racial identity are put to work in ways that result in deeply ambivalent outcomes at the local level. Elsewhere in Peru, long-term research by Amanda Stronza at an eco lodge in the southeastern Amazon area shows that competition for tourism revenues has resulted in local concern to manifest Indigenous identity and culture. In this case, gender appears to be less significant than ethnic identity as an area characterized by mixed native communities. It remains to be seen to what degree tourism is a benefit, offering new economic resources and validation for Indigenous identity, and to what degree it may promote new inequalities as both potential income and ethnic identity are contested sites. In an ironic twist, as the community seeks modern progress, it is, as Stronza puts it, considering the possibility that a return to the past, reclaiming traditions, retention of language and dress, may be the best path to a prosperous future. End of the quote. Recent research on indigenous women in the Latin American region suggests that women's position may undergo the greatest change in regions where they participate in local women's movements or in indigenous movements that offer substantial attention to gender injustice and seek to overcome it. This could account for the greater visibility of women, for example, in Zapatista communities, where I've also worked, than in Andean Peru. In times and places where women recognize the need to assert their own rights, they clearly tend to have a more prominent role, both in local politics and in tourism development. Tourists themselves often seek opportunities to interact more with indigenous women, and this may serve to draw women into more active engagement with tourism. To be sure, as women participate more in tourism, they may lose some of the apparent authenticity that serves to attract tourists in the first place. My work supports the view that while tourism may result in deeply ambivalent outcomes, it is critical to sort through the ways that identities are shifting in response to new challenges and new opportunities for those who have been marginalized historically. For indigenous women whose full citizenship rights have been denied in the past, even short-term gains may be used strategically to advance their individual and collective interests. Peoples and nations that increasingly look to tourism for economic and political stabilization frequently refashion their cultural identities and histories to draw travelers. The emergence of indigenous social movements in Ecuador and Bolivia, bordering Peru, as in, for example, southern Mexico and Guatemala, have the double advantage of asserting rights at the national level and of capturing the interests of international travelers and supporters. The Andean and other regions thus have a higher profile for those considering their options for travel destinations. They hold the cachet of having made recent international headlines and the security of having emerged from deeper conflict. Women, whether exoticized for their cultural difference or simply admired for their artisan skills and newfound activism, are coming to play a more important part in the tourism encounter in these post-conflict and transitional societies. Being more Indian can emerge as something more than a social liability and become a source of cultural capital. These women's growing visibility, their social and political participation, and even their marketing of Chola Barbies or Zapatista dolls to tourists suggests that in some cases, under the new terms of engagement with tourism, women are taking gradual steps from the margin toward the center. And thank you. Shall we see if there are comments or questions?
Or comments, please.
There's a question in the back. Or yes, I see you. The question was in relation to sex tourism, which in fact I excised from what I presented here because I simply didn't think I'd have time, but it is very important, and it's something that in my book I actually devote a chapter to, particularly looking at sex and romance tourism in Cuba and Nicaragua. In the case of Mexico and Peru, the other two countries where I've done research on tourism, you don't see it in quite the same forms, just to the same extent. However, limiting what I say right here to Peru, yes, there is sex tourism in Peru, and I did mention the brilleros, the which has to do a little more with romance tourism. It's about cultivating personal relationships with tourists to to acquire both, I think, affection and also, in many cases, some material gain, though it's not an exchange of cash for sex in such a direct way as in sex tourism. However, yes, and in the selva area of Peru, particularly, we hear of sex tourism in Iquitos, and certainly it exists elsewhere in the country, and it is critically important. So when I refer to the ambivalence of tourism, this is part of what I refer to. It's the you know, there have been a lot of feminist critiques of tourism and commodification and the particular commodification of women's bodies that in some instances is part of that experience. In Cuba, it's very well known, and that's where I've spent, you know, some of my time in recent years as well. But I guess I'm trying to do here is to avoid going directly to the view that tourism will only be exploitative, or that in the end it's undermining women's opportunities. I think we can see the proactive ways here too that women are asserting themselves and becoming involved in some touristic encounters. This, by the way, this piece that I've offered on Peruvian tourism, I often have related to the southern Mexican case of Chiapas, and there you can see where women are more actively engaged, and particularly in the Zapatista social movement. I think you can see women less behind the scenes and a little bit more prominently involved in tourism. So part of what I conclude is that in the comparative cases, you know, you can see where women are more involved in movements for change. They not surprisingly have a more prominent role in tourism as well. So I think you bring out something important here, which I hope in my broader project I don't neglect, and I keep in mind here as well. It's important. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Winifred. And the question was, for anyone who didn't hear it and so that it's recorded, what about tourism as a development strategy, and particularly is it replacing other rural development strategies and so forth? And one thing that I had found particularly interesting in some of the places that I've gone to do my research is rural communitarian tourism projects, in some cases spinning off of participation in agricultural communities like coffee plantations, coffee production, having on the side tourism projects that would complement what is being undertaken in the way of agricultural development. And I think probably the answer has to be that, yeah, these are struggling local economies that feel a need to do something else to augment their livelihoods, and I think that's the most common reason why rural communities do engage in tourism. It's that they are not meeting all of their needs. There are studies out there. Sarah Lyons has worked on coffee tourism. There are other forms of agricultural tourism, being able to stay in agricultural communities. I suppose you could describe the Vicos case a little bit that way, because people do go out and participate in the work of the Vicosinos as well, and they would say that they're doing it because they have needs that aren't being met, despite the fact that they're landholders, they do practice agriculture. But they've been supplementing their livelihoods in different kinds of ways over generations, whether it has meant going out to perform some kind of wage work beyond the community, you know. So it's not entirely new that they're participating in the commodified tourist market. They've been participating in the commodified economy, wider economy, for some time. So I think that's a partial answer, at least, to what you're suggesting. I guess I don't know if anyone else would want to comment very broadly on that question, but I wouldn't feel quite qualified to say whether rural development is being undermined or to the degree that the people are turning to tourism. But tourism is arguably the world's leading industry, and so it shouldn't surprise us if rural communities are wanting to participate to some degree in it. It's something that almost everybody can offer a visit to a community. You know, it's something that's available, and yes.
I've
gotten some sense of this, I think, from spending time in four different contexts. Again, you know, I think it might take more systematic study to see if I could do some linking of, or if someone could do some linking of participation in tourist economies and in sort of like assets, I guess. You know, at what point can we say that gender relations have really shifted? I think that's a huge question. But I in the same way that a long time ago I read the archives from the community of Vicos, relating to the 50s and 60s, and I was reading in the 70s, and drawing some conclusions about social relations through the narratives, the interviews, and so forth, I think we can get some suggestive material from qualitative interviews, and so I was interested, even in the Vicos context, where I'm suggesting that women are critically important, and yet they aren't often so publicly recognized, and aren't performing the role of hosts in the same way that often the men are. Nevertheless, at moments you have insights into their personalities and involvement in tourism, and with my first host, with the woman host, Maria, or Toradora, I guess I call her, she actually came around when I was talking to her husband, who came in the evening to talk about some of the stories, you know, the sort of the Andean lore, the Andean cosmovision, and so forth, and as he was telling me something about trial marriage in the Andes, which is a subject to some anthropological interest going way back, and there's a Quechua word for it, and he was telling me it was a time for men to check out to see whether the marriage was going to work for him, and I sort of joked that, well, it was no doubt a time for women to be checking out whether it was going to work for them, and Dora cracked up laughing. And so despite the fact that she did not offer a lot of Spanish in conversation, she nonetheless understood and was I think a player. I think she was a player in the domestic context that I could see. Perhaps it's interesting for me to sort of calculate what other tourists are experiencing from seeing those tourists and seeing what is the kind of script, if there is a script, for the tourism visit. And I think a lot of people do come away from such a visit thinking that this is a place in which time has stood still. It's a kind of a museumification of a community, even if perhaps if people are looking, they're noticing the technologies that people have access to and want to have access to, and increasingly now cell phones in rural communities and so forth. So, but nonetheless, I think a lot of people do go in hoping to find a place that is like it was in generations past, and so no doubt come out with such an idea. But I think what we do see some degree of, I guess I might use the word empowerment. I didn't use the word in my presentation. I wouldn't use it too loosely, but I would suggest that in some contexts we see women's involvement, and I guess I would say in some of the cases I know from Chiapas more so. Cuba, perhaps, where women are involved And often, as you may know, Cuba, highly educated population, even if they've been hurting economically in some ways, but they women are involved in the tourism industry there, and when it's going beyond the sex tourism industry, in which they are certainly also involved, there is a kind of pro-activism among that group of women. So I want to be seeing a space for that kind of activity, which you could say is empowering. Yeah. I know we're almost out of time. I don't know.
We're final.
Oh, are we? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Good.
Okay. Yeah.
And the question sort of piggybacks on that one, and that is this question of Candice Masundika, right? Or Candice Masundio. Is that, I know you're sort of looking at it from a kind of foreigners and tourist perspective. Is that also a question that would matter to Andean peoples themselves? Because I see like in Guatemala in the 90s, that was a question that Maya, for example, talked about a lot of themselves, but today, not so much. You know, it's more, you talk about Wild Little's book, it's more how the tourists see them that matter. And that also kind of, in their own kind of family lives, it wasn't as if they're saying, hey, you're not as unique in that because you don't speak, or you drink Coke or whatever it is, black and modern.
Yeah, that too is something that's interested me, intrigued me in recent times, because I've taken in a questionnaire which I've tried to get at that question, and sometimes it is hard to see if it's a salient sort of question. When Marisol de la Cadena framed her position on this before, she wasn't really talking about from the tourist perspective. I mean, you're right that now I'm sort of asking it a number of different dimensions of it. Are women perceived that way, but are they that way? She was speaking about the kind of double or maybe even triple subordination of women in the context of southern Peru in which she was working. I had worked a few years before that, and not to say, but she was referencing my work as one in which maybe you would say women as marketers were more thoroughly integrated in local economies. I had worked on market women in the 70s in north central Peru, and came to the conclusion that women were vitally important economically. And so she does allow in her own work, in a footnote, I believe it was, that in some contexts women's work is valued and might not conform to the notion that women are more Indio. Well, whether today the question has salience, since I'm now looking at gender and indigenous identity, questions around cultural identity broadly, I have tried hard to frame questions that could get people talking about, whether they think it makes a difference, to be a woman of this community, a man of this community, what it means to be of this community also. And often you get a kind of, maybe it's a little bit of a pushback on it, people suggesting, well, how do I like to be called, or how do I think of myself? Well, I think of myself as a Vicocino or a Vicocina. I think of myself as a member of this community. And if you do broach the question of, well, what about the relationship of rural to urban? What is the relationship there? And there's a long history of discrimination between the rural and urban sectors in this part of Peru. And yet, perhaps it's because more young people in communities are seeking to go live in those towns and cities that there's a bit of a refusal sometimes to want to talk about difference. And then other times, yes, people will talk about the social stigma that persists of being rural. We'd hear certain words used to describe, particularly women of the rural sector, polleronas, women who wear those polleras, those big skirts. And that's become a very salient kind of symbol of cultural identity. It's both what might account for women being perceived as more indigenous when women retain that dress more than men are retaining traditional dress. But women, very often younger women, are changing their dress style as well. Language use is another very salient marker, and who's speaking Quechua and who's not. And there's a concern among a number of people that the next generation will barely speak Quechua because it's just not being used, even by children of Quechua speakers who may be monolingual or bilingual with Spanish. So there are a number of major cultural shifts going on, and I think that may account for a bit of both the difficulty people have in talking about this, and yet you, I think as an observer, you can see moments of great social friction, and so I'm trying to do both: listen to what people have to say and take that very seriously, and then also observe moments where there are interactions and try to see and hear what might be at stake, you know.
Is there one more question for us? I lived in Mexico on and off in the 1990s when the Zapatismo emerged and put forward, you know, a really progressive agenda for the nation. And many, this is a problematic term, mestizo Mexicans rejected it, not just on the right, which you might expect, but the left, mm-hmm. which was strong in Mexico at the time. So knowing little about Peru, how open are mestizos in Lima or other cities to reimagining Peru that has room for Quechua people as part of the nation?
Well, of course, with the heavy migration and the fact that so much of a city like Lima is made up of Andean migrants, it's changing certainly the face of the city. So who counts as, you know, but I understand your question. And, you know, for those people who have lived in a place like Lima for many years or even many generations, you know, is there room for a space of change? Well, I think it's very much a negotiated process, not surprisingly, for now. And there has been some interesting work that suggests that that there's still a very strong basis for discrimination, and that discrimination does have gendered effects. And I might note that it also has gendered effects among Andean migrants themselves, so that it may seem counterintuitive, but male migrants may abuse women for being too serrana, being, you know, and they're asked, why would you want to marry a serrana? That's the question that has come up in one recent study of violence against women in Lima, that it's violence within their cultural group, but it stems from, I think, a broader stigma that still pertains to the Indian population. So I think yes, of course there's room for change, and of course there's a negotiation, and the face of the city is changing. The face of so-called mestizo, and it's not a term you hear as much anymore in Peru either, though I think in the past it was understood in social terms, not in the kind of old mixed race terms, but in social terms. And it's a little hard to find the right language right now, I think. And maybe we just don't need the language. Maybe it's all about rural and urban, but I think there are some finer distinctions there that it's been my job to try to find out more about, I guess. And so.
Just one last question, then. It's related.
Is that okay?
Yeah. Very quick. In fact, related to both of the past two questions, and that is whether the tourism ecosystem that you've been talking about, whether that's in fact international, or whether there's a domestic.
Yeah, you know, in contrast to domestic tourism heading for Huaraz, which is the place where I usually have my base when I go to Peru, there you find a lot of folks from Lima, particularly in other parts of Peru, but a lot from Lima because the road is good. You can get to Huaraz in about 7 hours on a good road, and so that enables domestic tourism in a way that, and typically people from Lima who would come would go on some of the day trips that go to about four different sites, one of them being the Chavín archaeological site, and then there are several other, you know, a lake and, you know, this kind of thing, but not to go visit the rural community like Ficos. That would be most surprising, I think. I haven't encountered Peruvian tourists going there. I would ask the question, has anyone come here? Mostly U.S. and quite a number from the Netherlands, because there's a tour operator from the Netherlands and has sort of a pipeline. But so you do find mainly Europeans and folks from the U.S. Crooked Trails, based in Seattle, is a travel outfit that has sent a number of travelers to Vicos. So I'd have to say that I have not seen domestic tourism heading for this kind of site. Now, maybe elsewhere in Peru, there may be some younger Peruvian travelers who are heading for communities, but typically they're foreigners. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.